now I'm the mouthpiece on a national stage for a cause and a fight that's been happening since the beginning of this nation. And so mm-hmm. there's like these weighty things that I'm, you know, I'm trying to navigate.
Yeah.
All while, okay, I need to hit this free throw right now.
Lead by Example with Bob Myers is presented for the people by Caesars Sportsbook. You bet, you get with Caesars Rewards. Must be 21 or older.
Welcome to Lead by Example. I'm your host, Bob Myers. Today we have the privilege of welcoming Maya Moore Irons on the program. And I'm really excited. I don't know you. Obviously know of you. You probably don't know of me. But, you know, looking at your life or your career, I can't believe how much you've actually won. You win at such a high level. And some people I've gotten to be around in my life have won as well. But you, it's amazing. And I'm wondering, when you were young, a young girl, was that just always how it went for you? Or did something happen? Or were you just better? Or were you more willing? Do you remember that far back and when something triggered or anything happened?
Yeah, I think so much. Well, one of the exciting reasons that I'm excited to share more of my story with the world is because a lot of people were introduced to me, you know, on a national stage after I had become a winner.
Yeah.
And so there was so much work, so much life that had happened before then. So I'd say around high school is when, you know, people started to know me for basketball. And, but so much life had happened before that. I was born to a single mom in the middle of the country in Missouri, and was raised with a whole bunch of loving extended family. And my mom would call me, she called me a very spirited child. So I was always running around. I had a lot of energy. And so naturally she tried to put me in something organized to get that energy out.
Right.
Through the encouragement of my great aunt, she was like, well, so-and-so runs a girls basketball team down the road. Why don't you sign her up for that? So
yeah.
It really wasn't any more planned out than that. And right. So I started to play sports. I played every sport you could think of. And I eventually just kept playing AAU year after year after year after year. And around 11, 12 years old, I really started to become a little more separated than my peers. I grew a lot.
Yeah.
And I just really love to, I have a very engaged, focused personality when it comes to things that I want to do.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that that energy and the focus and the achievement that I'm pretty achievement driven. So I think that combination, as well as just having great support and being in the right place at the right time, really helped me get to so many winning situations.
When you say achievement oriented, does that mean when you were young, you were going into an AAU tournament thinking, I got to win this thing because it feels great to win? Or were you one of those people that was, your word, spirited, meaning I can't stand feeling what it feels like to lose?
You know, I think my relationship with sport and playing had a lot of really good foundations. I think, but I definitely learned some things. I had to grow and adjust. I just like doing well. Like if there's something to do and I'm on a group and the teacher or the coach or the adult says, this is your goal, now go out and do it. I'm like, all right, let's go. Just because it's a goal.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do it. And so if I didn't do it, I'd be upset. But when I was younger, it was like, oh man, this doesn't feel good, but where are we going to eat pizza?
Okay,
really a sweet kind of tender place.
Yeah.
But as I got older, it was like, okay, I got a little more into kind of perfectionism and I had to kind of check myself of like, okay. And then coaches, you know, guiding me along the way of how to balance, like wanting to achieve, but also leaving space for failure.
And your mom, so is that, you know, we always, as we look back and you're older now and you're a mom yourself and you wonder, what made you? Did you know, or when did it click in your mind? Like, my mom is doing a lot. She's carrying a pretty big load to do what she does. And you mentioned you moved around. She had different jobs. You know, the AAU circuit isn't easy. I don't know if she came and watched your games or if she was able to or could afford to. I don't even know how that works for single moms, how they even do it. But were you cognizant of that growing up? Did you say, wow, my mom, she's pretty unique? Or did that come later?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the normal experience of the older I got, the more I realized, oh, wow, my mom is awesome.
Right.
I think one of the points that I remember, I think, noticing more was middle school when we moved. I grew up in Jefferson City, Missouri until I was 11 years old. And growing up in a single parent household with a mom who got up and went to work every day was normal to me. And I just saw her model hard work. And but also she would take me to every practice and she would be there for everything. And so, again, the two of the biggest things role modeled for me was hard work and showing up.
Yeah.
So she made it work. I think she made it to every single one of my AAU practices and games until I was 16.
Yeah.
So she had pretty much two full-time jobs of being with me and supporting me and working. But also, you know, I end up sharing in the book that we had some extra family support too when times got hard. So we needed a community. We needed family to make sure my mom was able to be there for me and just to have that steady support.
You seem really measured. And is that a reason? Have you always had this demeanor about you? Pretty calm. I mean, very kind of thoughtful. And, you know, for somebody that's won it, you're like, is that always you? Is that you? Is that who you are? Is that an evolution of you or?
Yeah, both. I think both. I don't think I was very measured as a kid. I was more of like my mom having to come to school because I wouldn't stop talking, getting in trouble. So I was definitely a very high energy, kind of just do what I feel kind of a kid. But I think as I got older and just became more aware of the fact that what I do matters and the way I impact people matters and we impact each other. I think just becoming more aware of as a teammate, more aware of, oh, people are listening to me. It just made me kind of pause, and even having the opportunity to speak on a national stage to media as a high schooler, it just kind of made me practice being a little more mindful of what I was saying and how I was coming off. I don't know, maybe just being an older cousin and knowing like I'm a role model and what I say, you know, what I say and do has consequences. And I think it's definitely part of my personality.
Now, there's a story that when you were at UConn, I don't know if this is true, but I guess they played Jeopardy or something and you lost and you couldn't handle it. It sets you off course for the whole day. I mean, are you that kind of, and the reason that resonates a little bit is, did you ever interact, you probably did, with Kobe Bryant? I'm sure you met him.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know him well, or?
I interacted with Kobe maybe once or twice.
Okay, so I met him when I was 20-ish, 22 or 3, and was around him enough to know, you know, wasn't hard to see his drive for anybody, but I got to see off the court competitiveness and how kind of crazy irrational it was, but in a way that told you why he was so successful on the court. To the point of, and the reason I bring that story up about you is I find that some of the people that are the most successful athletes, that's everywhere in their life. And sometimes hard to corral. You don't seem, again, I don't know you very well at all. You don't seem like the one that flips over the Monopoly table after a loss, but maybe there's like a side to you that you just, it comes out when you step into that that fire or that moment. Is that, or maybe that was you, and that's you know, that's a hard thing to carry around all the time.
Yeah. I mean, everything you just said, it hits on it a little bit, the kind of in the evolution of me. I think when I was younger, like I was mentioning about like the perfectionism kind of taking over and coming out of, I would get very outwardly frustrated when things weren't going well, or if I was losing or not, you know, not doing as well as I wanted. And then when I got to UConn is like this incubator for competitiveness. You have all the most competitive, talented players that have an opportunity to be brought into that program. And the years I was there, it was just, it was unreal, you know, with players like Renee Montgomery and Tina Charles. And we were just a really competitive bunch. And so we would play games, like you mentioned. And if I didn't win, and I would not like that. And so I think the height of my competitiveness in that way was really formed at UConn. And then you get to the pros and you realize, okay, the amount of energy and passion that you put into college is different than the pros, because the pros is a long game. Like, college is 4 years, one season at a time. You're still 18, 19, 20. And you just, you're really bonded with your team. It's just a unique experience. When the pros, like, you're playing on different teams, you're playing for years and years and years. And so you have to learn how to really be efficient. And so I think my, my competitiveness and my passion transitioned into efficiency. And then, you know, just later on in my life, I still like to play and do well. I still have an achievement itch, but I also think the perspective that I have about where my energy and passion goes into and how animated I get about something is a little different than it would have been 10 years ago.
It was. Would you say you were on all the teams? I mean, you don't have to say it, but I imagine you were on most of your teams, if not all, the best player. Were you also the leader? I mean, was that natural for you, or were you, because on our team, I could say Steph Curry's a leader, but Draymond Green's another type of leader, very different personalities, but I don't know your teams. Was it at UConn, was it when you walked in the room and at halftime, when you said something, or did you, whether it was pros, when you're playing with a lot of different people, how would you characterize yourself in that vein?
Yeah, I have such a unique journey in that my leadership journey was so healthy, I think, and just so helpful to me, because generally, even in high school, the teams that I entered in, when I entered onto a team, there were seniors or upperclassmen or vets that knew what they were doing. And so I didn't have to immediately come in and be the person. I was still going to be me and be very effective, but I was not the fullness of the leader that I would become after a few years of growing, having Coach Oriyama, you know, open my eyes to some things about leadership and just, you know, developing those relational skills that it takes to be a leader, you know, within your personality. I think there were some relational lessons I had to grow and learn in. I think I was pretty good at doing my own thing, but I had to learn, how do I do my own thing, but also do that with other players in a way that really just buys them in and inspires and encourages and brings out the best in them, other than just being a good player myself, if that makes sense. But I learned how to be a vocal leader and try to be measured again about what I say, so that when I say something, it's helpful. But I always led by example, literally everywhere that I go. It's just, that's the type of person I am. I try to lead by example.
What's like the best, you know, and I want to get to what you're doing now and your book and everything, all, which I think is all more important than all this. And I curious to see what you feel, but, as far as playing, what you're most proud of, and was there a moment where you used that leadership skill where you were, that you can recall and say, you know what, this was a hard moment? Because usually when you have to lead, many times is not an easy thing. and you said, I had to do this, and I did do it, and it worked out, or maybe it even didn't work out, but I had to say something, I had to do something in that capacity?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think the first thing that's actually popping in my mind is an example from high school where we had a player who was having some major struggles off the court in her personal life, and it was impacting our practices, like our team,
right,
as far as the standard and the bar that we, you know, the coaches had set and that we had set, this player wasn't meeting. And so it was like, what do we do? Do we kick this person off the team? Like, do we hold the bar, you know, hold the line? Like, how do we get through this? And, you know, I'm like 16, 17 years old and just talking through it with the coach at the time and my mom. And it was one of those things of like, well, let's just invite her over for dinner. Let's like really connect with the person because clearly something's up. We don't just, you know, say, hey, you're not cutting it. See you later. And I remember that of kind of a bigger than basketball moment of like, at the end of the day, it's not necessarily about holding the line of performance. It's about, it's about people. And what can I do to help you be well? Cause that's what sports should be about. It should be about bringing out the best in each other and in our communities. And so, I remember learning that lesson or getting a chance to start learning that lesson early on in high school like that.
Yeah.
She ended up staying on the team and we ended up winning a lot of games after that.
Yeah. It's fascinating that you referenced the people part because, people listening, I mean, you know this better than I do even, but these team frameworks are so intimate that to skip the part about who someone is makes it hard to function as a team. You know, if you just gloss over and say, oh, we're just on the court together, eventually the humanity of it comes in, good or bad. Maybe more in college, like you said, it's more fraternal or it's more of a close-knit thing. But in the pros, there's maybe more at stake. There's more pressure. There's more scrutiny. Not UConn, I don't know that you can get more pressure than that. But I think it's fascinating that people assume these environments are just people show up and play basketball together. Mm-hmm. When in fact, it's, you know, planes, weekends, holidays, injuries, families, spouses, and to connect with someone like you did, that's interesting that you learned that at a pretty young age to say, if I'm going to break through here, I can't just give them a speech on go see a therapist, you know, get your life together. It doesn't work that way. So that's really interesting.
More Lead by Example after this.
Have you been betting with the Caesars Sportsbook and Casino app? If so, keep it up because every bet earns with Caesars rewards. That means win or lose, you're getting closer to amazing perks like game tickets, free stays, bonuses, and more. And if not, well, when you get started, your first bet is on Caesars. Register with promo code OMAHAFULL and place your first bet up to $1,250. If you win, congrats. If you don't, you'll get your stake back as a free bet. Must be 21 or older, offer valid, and must be physically present in Arizona, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Michigan, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wyoming only. New users and first $10 plus wager only. Must register with eligible promo code. Bet amount of qualifying wager returned only if wager is settled as a loss. Maximum bet credit $1,250. Must be used within 14 days of receipt. Tier credits and reward credits will be added to account within 7 days after qualifying wager settles. See Caesars.com/promos for full terms. Void where prohibited. Know when to stop before you start. Gambling problem. Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. Colorado, Wyoming, Kansas. Affiliated with Kansas Crossing Casino, call 1-800-522-4700. Indiana, call 1-800-9-WITH-IT. Iowa, call 1-800-BETS-OFF. Louisiana, call 1-877-770-STOP. Licensed through Horseshoe, Bossier City, and Harrah's, New Orleans. Michigan, call 1-800-270-7117. Illinois, Maryland, New Jersey, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania. Affiliated with Harrah's, Philadelphia. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, crisis counseling and referral services can be accessed by calling 1-800-GAMBLER. 1-800 1-800-426-2537. Or West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NEW YORK or text HOPE-NEW YORK 467-369.
And we're back.
So now your book, and I want to, I mean, it's all in there, but when you, first of all, writing a book, I want to talk about that part, but I want to save that for later. But before the book, there are things you did and decisions you made that I want to talk about how you made them and how easy or hard they were. Because, and I want you to tell your story too, as best you can, in that I decided, you decided I'm going to spend my energy here. And was that clear? Was that strong in you, or was there conflict? Walk me through your journey and your fight for justice. The book's called Love and Justice, for your husband. Now you have a family. That's the uniqueness of you. I mean, obviously you're unique in your success as an athlete and as a leader, but now this is a step most don't take, right? There's a sacrifice to it. There's a selflessness to it. But how does that all live in you? I know that's a big question.
Yeah.
But when did that kind of bubble up in you, or how?
Yeah. Well, we're on a journey, right? We're living every day. We're growing. We're being shaped. And I think it'd be hard for me to articulate this journey if I didn't articulate the most important relationship in my life, which is God and my faith and how my worldview of life and what matters most is heavily influenced by Jesus. And so mm-hmm. I came into basketball with that already in process, mm-hmm. that relationship already happening. And so I would like to think I'm growing every day, every year, in maturity, in love, in becoming more of who I was created to be. And so all this is happening, mainly behind the scenes, because that's not something you really get to see in someone unless you live life with them. And so I am, growing and wrestling with the dynamic of trying to be faithful in my context of being a pro and mm-hmm. just being helpful and being a loving person, being life-giving, but also being well and not killing myself. 'Cause you can easily kill yourself in any successful industry by just going too hard and not counting the cost. Of success. And so I'm navigating that side of things. I'm navigating my personal relationship with Jonathan, in our own relationship, as you'll see more in the book, of how that was growing and the nuances of that. And then there's another dynamic of, now because I decided to use my voice to shine a light on Jonathan's plight and the plight of many others and systematic issues and community issues, now I'm the mouthpiece on a national stage for a cause and a fight that's been happening since the beginning of this nation. And so mm-hmm. there's like these weighty things that I'm trying to navigate.
Yeah.
All while, I need to hit this free throw right now. It's like there's so many layers to us as human beings, right?
A lot.
And so I think, in 2018, probably the last few years of my career. And again, I'm glad I got a chance to touch some on this in the book. It's not the whole book, but some of my journey in the book of just, I'm more and more realizing what my heart is beating for and the things that I'm passionate about and the energy that I have and where is my energy pulled, because to do what I did and to do what we do takes an extraordinary amount of energy and focus and commitment. Like you said, a lot of people just think we show up and this just happens. Not literally, but all of the work that it takes
only a small percentage of what it takes is able to be seen. And that makes sense, you know, if you're not in our lives. But I think by the time...
Let me just interrupt you for one thing. Sure. When you said, it's interesting, when you said you had to weigh, only you could understand, when you said the success could be killing you, that's an interesting thing because you know the cost of the success personally, right? Yeah. You know what it takes to do what you did. Most people I find don't really care about the cost because it's not their cost. Right. You're making them happy. Your life from afar seems perfect. No one's is. Mm-hmm. But then you had to sit with yourself and your faith and say, what am I doing this for? And who am I doing this for? And I guess you, as you said, the last few years of your career, or then there was a moment where you go, I know the answer. I just got to do it now. I would imagine there was pretty decent opposition, not mean-spirited, but how much support did you have to make that decision? Or how much opposition did you have where it was kind of like, Maya, what do you do that later? Or that nobody's going to fix that. You know, let somebody else do that. You're wasting your time. I mean, how did you find that conviction? And you mentioned your faith. Were there also things you had to work through, kind of voices, people, I don't know, anybody that you kind of had to go, yeah, I hear you, but.
Right. You know. Yeah, I get your question. I'm laughing because part of it, people that know me know that I don't listen to a lot of people. I have a small group of people. I don't put my trust into people very easily. I love people. I'm kind to people. Yeah. But as far as the weight that someone has in influencing my heart or my life or my mind, I'm very, very, very picky about that. And also, more science is coming out. Our brains were not created to have all that input anyway. Like, sure. We were created and designed in a way to where we really can only hold, you know, like 3 people intimately, 12 people kind of medium intimately, maybe 50 people kind of acquaintance. And then our brains can't handle anything else. And so I think I had a pretty good rhythm with having wise counsel around me and people who actually knew what was going on with me, that I was actually listening to. And so I don't think I struggled at all with people asking questions that didn't know me. Like, I don't have the energy to try to listen or explain to someone who doesn't know me. But the people that do know me, I would share and wrestle and process with. And the people that do know me love me and want me well. And I think the other half of that question is, I wasn't well. And so it wasn't just this neutral decision. It was layered of, it wasn't just about Jonathan's cause. That was a big part of what I wanted to be present for, but it was just a general, I think, shift that I needed to make to be well. And so, you know, when I
You weren't well? Like,
I was not well. I was not feeling like I needed to be in the pro space. You know, mentally, emotionally, my desire.
Was it a sadness, or was it just what didn't feel like yourself? Or
it's one of those things where you feel like this is not where I'm supposed to be, but I'm here. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know what to do about it, and so there's an anxiety that comes with that. There's a sadness that comes with that. But I also was very committed to that space and had friends and I'm one of those people, like, when I'm in, I'm in. And so to come out of something when you're one of those I'm in people, it's a whole thing. So so I knew I needed to step away so I could rest and get well and really use my energy in the spaces that I needed to at home for my own rhythm of life and to prepare for Jonathan's fight and the future that I was hoping that we would be able to have together. And it totally paid off, but I also still use energy to invest into that public space of advocating and advocacy, which is a whole nother type of energy that where you see yeah. opposition and, you know, people that don't know you saying things about it. It can be, you know, a discouraging space, but at the same time, I still had a lot of focus on actually, you know, listening to people that I knew, because I know Jonathan. So yeah. I have a level of yeah. confidence in speaking with authority because I had witnessed so many things over a decade plus. And so I just wanted yeah. to speak into that and try to be helpful, which again, took yeah. a lot of energy and still does.
Did you have feelings, were your feelings for him, did you, as you embarked on it, were those things that were there previously or like dormant or developed or strong going into it? You know, were those things that you discovered or discovered that were always there? I don't, how would you describe that connection?
Yeah. Oh, our story. So interesting. Very unexpected. And, you know, we share about that a good bit in the book.
Yeah.
But yeah. I will say we had been forming a relationship. We were friends for about 6 years before we
right.
realized that more than friendship was there. And so then we yeah. had to realize, okay, what do we do with this? Because this is not normal.
Sure.
Like, there's no roadmap to this. Right. And how do we, like, we're sure. friends before anything else. So how do we protect each other? How do we help each other while also being honest?
Yeah.
And so we navigated that. And so, I think one of the hardest things to do was, you know, I was trying to advocate for him, but also protect our privacy, because it's just sure. the reality that sort of news and information would have majorly distracted from his fight and his cause,
yeah.
the cause
yeah.
that deserved mm-hmm. all of the focus yeah. and all the attention exactly how we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really proud sure. of navigating that. Every single bit of information is not for everybody. And so,
sure.
you know, over time we would share what we thought was most helpful and beneficial to share.
Right.
And now in the book, we're sharing some more. And so I love yeah. how we did that. But it was also hard because it's like when you're in love and you love people,
yeah.
you just want to shout it from the rooftops or
yeah.
kind of just not yeah. have to think about that.
But we can do it now.
Yeah, we can do it now.
As far as going into a prison, how much of that did you end up doing? Or what was your first? Because I only know, very different story, but I've been in San Quentin probably 9 or 10 times, mm-hmm. got to know some of the inmates, their stories. And, you know, it's hard to describe to people. It's hard to describe what that experience is like.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you would describe it. And I didn't have obviously I didn't have the relationship that you have, that was what you were doing. And it wasn't a fight like yours. It was just more of, hey, show some care for these people.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up wrote some letters for some people and things like that, but nowhere near your thing. But what would you say, and I'm sure you've spoken on this, heading into that environment, that experience and what you felt?
Yeah. So the first time I visited Jonathan at the Jefferson City Correctional Center, I was about 18 years old. You know, I was heading into my freshman year at UConn, and I went with my godparents, Sherry and Reggie Williams. And so I grew up with my godparents in Missouri. And then when we moved, we stayed in touch. They would come to my games in the holidays. And so we were still close. And so they were telling me about Jonathan's story about 2 years before I went in there. And so I had kind of known about Jonathan, had heard about him. And so I trusted, you know, my godparents. And so I wasn't just going in blind.
Sure.
So I think that helped me kind of have you know, less anxiety and uncertainty, but it is definitely a humbling experience. I think more than anything, when you get to hear somebody's story and actually put your perspective down to pick up someone else's perspective, it's very humanizing. It's humbling yeah. because you realize, oh, my perspective isn't the only perspective. It's not the true perspective. Yeah. Like, you need multiple perspectives and multiple angles and vantage points to even try to wrap your mind around truth. And so that was helpful for me to hear about his story, to appreciate what I have, and to see what he didn't have and how he still somehow is survived and is as well as he is, even though he's been through a lot of trauma. He's still living and giving life to people. Even from that prison, he was a life-giving source. And I just was so inspired and just humbled that I thought it was an honor and a privilege to have a friend like him, because it was just extraordinary what he was trying to do and the life that he was trying to live despite his injustice and his circumstances. So, but again, not everybody is wrongfully convicted, right? So you go into prison and, you know, you just realize these are human beings. Everyone here is a human being.
Yeah.
And let me just listen. If you just start with that posture and that approach, you are going to become a better human and probably help someone else feel more human just simply with that approach.
Yeah. What you said is interesting, because when I would, you know, and I think what you said about the perspective, leaving your own and picking up theirs is a very succinct and good way of saying it, because I found when I would leave, people would say, thanks for coming. And the thanks was to them for revealing that part about life. It's kind of like, if I was raised like a lot of these guys were, probably decent chance I'm sitting where they are. You know, none of us can say we're so strong or better to overcome some impossible circumstances, you know? And so even the ones that were, like you said, not everybody's wrongly convicted. Some admit to their crimes, and many, but also how they got there is the part that I think gets skipped over. And so, you know, I think Jonathan's story is completely different, because that was, like you said, injustice. So I didn't get to experience. So when you're in that capacity, I don't understand how someone can be what he is and what he was in the face of that, right? Because we all talk about, oh, life's not fair. Well, what about that?
Yeah,
you know, kind of like, they cut me off, or the coach didn't play me. Oh, I didn't make varsity as a sophomore. Right. Oh my God.
He was such a good,
how does he,
he was such a good reality check for me. I think something was hard and I'd be like, hold on. And I'd get off of a phone call with Jonathan and I'd be like, my life is nothing compared to that. Let me get it together and keep pushing. So,
What was it, his faith? Or is it, you know, I guess I can't, you can't imagine sitting in prison wrongly. I don't think anybody can imagine that. We can try.
Right.
And you'd like to think, this isn't fair. So that drives me, that motivates me. But there has to be moments of kind of like, so what, you know, so this is my life? Is it just, how did you move through that, or how did you watch him move through that? Mm-hmm. In his most is that faith? Is that an inner peace? Is that there was moments where he was furious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that. I think, man, what's coming to my mind when you're asking that question, and the thing that I'm realizing more and more as I grow older, is that everything is relationship. Like, everything is about the quality of the relationships that we have with God, with each other, with the ground, with nature. Like, everything is supposed to be working together and working towards peace with each other within the diversity of how everything has. Like, there's so much diverse creation, there's diverse people, and it's all flowing from our Creator. And so I think Jonathan having some foundation with his granny, who did the best she could to raise him. And then when Jonathan met my great uncle, Hugh Flowers, through a choir program, my great uncle just really saw Jonathan and breathed life into him and encouraged him. And mm-hmm. A relationship was formed where my great uncle essentially became like a father to Jonathan. Mm-hmm. And then through that mm-hmm. relationship, Jonathan met my godparents, because my godmom is my great uncle's daughter. And then mm-hmm. through that relationship, I met Jonathan. And mm-hmm. so he'll be the first one to tell you. And Jonathan had relationships inside with other men, other Christian men too, that mentored him, that kept him safe, that taught him things, some non-Christian, like just people coming into his life, impacting him, which helped him then impact other people. And so his key to survival and staying well was all relational, whether that was with God, whether that was with people encouraging him, and just with himself, of just so many people, a handful of people, not a ton, but just a handful. All you need is a handful of people to believe in you.
Yeah.
And you believe in yourself. And then he just, that combination of outside belief, inside belief, Heavenly Father belief, mentor belief, family belief. Like, you just got to keep having that rhythm of believing in your humanity and believing in life. And so I think that was, as well as going to the depths, like Jonathan goes there in the book. He talks about some of his darkest moments and how he was snatched out of near-death situations. So it's all of that.
The relationship part is so, you know, when you talked about playing and you talk about Jonathan and you talk about your counsel you keep, I think that I agree completely, but you say it very well, that the life, what moves you are your relationships, good or bad, right? And figuring out how you find those, how you keep those, mm-hmm. how you protect those. Mm-hmm. Somebody that's well known as you probably has to work a little harder, because you probably have great optionality. I mean, you can meet, you want to pick up and call President Obama, you probably can, or you have. You can say, I want to go talk to this person. And you could, but you sent, it seems to me, just talking to you, you have kind of that peace. I don't know. I it seems like you do. You seem like a pretty grounded, well thought out, and you joked about people that know you say you don't listen. I might say, like, you're pretty sure of your compass. You know, you don't seem to be, and I'm sure we're all have our own self-doubt, but I don't know if that's been you, that's who you are now through this recent, or if you're just in the perfect place now, maybe as a mom. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to talk about, like, what that did to you.
Yeah,
where you just feel like you have this clarity of mind and thought that is not, that's pretty rare.
Yeah,
it's pretty rare for not for somebody. That's just a rare thing in a person.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a aspect of my faith journey that when I was in middle school, I say this in the book, like I went to several different middle schools. And if any of us who are human remember middle school, it's not the most fun time. You are trying to figure yourself out. You are, again, with some of the brain science that's come out, like your identity and group identity is starting to be formed at like that puberty mm-hmm. time, like 12, 13, 14. And so mm-hmm. I had my group identity journey of like, who am I? Who are my people? Was disrupted in a way that worked out for me, because I ended up leaning more into God, and like that isolation and that loneliness actually cleared out things so that I could really kind of see what was real and what was mm-hmm. More true in that season of life. And then so I had a pretty strong sense of self and identity before basketball really took off. So I'm so thankful for that. I never really struggled with, is my identity, my performance, or is it basketball, which is a real struggle. But then I had to deal with learning that just because my identity is solid doesn't mean I can just not interact with people. Like, I would kind of probably lean more towards the I'm good, so I'm just going to do me.
Yeah.
As opposed to connect with people. So I had my own work to do in that. But I think some of what you're seeing as far as like, I never really gave into peer pressure. Like, that just wasn't my struggle. There's just some of that might be just how I'm wired in personality. But then I also think the vision that I learned from following Jesus as far as the path to life and what that looks like and the characteristics that looks like and the people, like what kind of people are we supposed to be and what kind of things are we supposed to value? And I really believed it, and I tried to go that way, and it led me to have more peace than I think I would have if I didn't. But I also think I'm at a point in life too, where I am more connected to people long-term than I ever have been. And so when I mentioned before about that, laying my perspective down to pick up someone else's, that's a recent lesson I've learned probably in the last like 2 years, like even more, like being married. Sure. If anybody's married, you know, like, you are tested as far as your ability to be selfish and thinking you're right and learning to lay things down in order to pick up somebody else's. So I think just the my clarity, I think more so is just a posture, just clarity of posture as I engage with people that is just about humility, and I'm still learning it. And I don't like always learning it, because we realize we have blind spots and we have weaknesses. And I do feel like I've grown so much over the last few years.
More Lead by Example after this. And we're back.
Is it hard? You talked about middle school. Sometimes when that stuff happens, you become almost hyper self-sufficient. And have you found in your life or your marriage where is it hard for you to ask for help?
Man, why'd you bring that up?
Are you kind of like that person that's like, I got this? What?
I said, why'd you bring that up? Self-sufficient? What? I don't. Asking for help? That's a real thing. That is, I mean, and you would think being a team player, like playing on a team, that would just be something we get good at. It's like, no, it's a whole deeply like rooted thing of being afraid that no one else is going to take care of you but you. And, you know, moving around like that in middle school and culture shock, moving from the Midwest to the South and not having friends and being tall, and then you know, when you are good at a sport, like, people treat you different, and there's perks that come with it, but then there's a loneliness, and it's just you trusting people's motives and intentions, and you know, you're moving around so much. So I think that I'm gonna take care of me, self-sufficient. I mean, even being a Black woman, you know, you got to take care of you, and just all the roots of that in our country's history. And it's a whole, there's some good to it. You know, you want to be self-aware.
Yeah, sure.
But there's also a beauty of interdependence that you miss out on.
I know.
If you don't have people in your life that you can depend on and work with and rest so that they can take care of you, or, you know, just that dynamic of asking for help. And so I think, again, I've grown in that a lot too.
Sure.
Over the last few years, but I've also witnessed as a player being on really good teams. Like, I've never really been on a bad team. I've been on.
Maybe you have something to do with that. You might have some personal.
I mean, yes, but I've played with other great players where I've seen like, oh, I don't have to do it all. But I still think there's that thing in a lot of us that still think we need to be ready to do it all at any moment. It's like,
How has your mom, you have a son, are you able to ask for help there? Or are you kind of the mom that's, I got this? Because I think no mom does. I'm not being critical of you. I have three daughters. My wife loves being a mom, and just finds that that's her thing. But, you know, for someone that, I also see mothers take on the weight of it all, you know, and you know a little bit what I'm talking about. You're like, I'm gonna do everything. You actually can't.
Yep.
But has that helped in your journey of like, I can't, he's gonna have to do some stuff or I need some help here.
Yeah.
Has that helped at all there?
You know, my path to motherhood, I became a mother later. You know, I was 33. So I was 32 when I had JJ. And like we were talking about, some of the things that I've been learning as far as humility, the cost of things. And so you have to say no, because I don't want to pay that mm-hmm. cost. I can't do it all.
Sure.
So I'm going to do what I feel yeah. called to do and do that with all I have. And so mm-hmm. those lessons of you can't do it all, we shouldn't do it all. Like, that's actually yeah. not how we sure. become our best as a human race. Like, we become our best mm-hmm. when we play our role. We have clarity about our role and we work together and we share, we give and take, we celebrate other people. Right. We do our thing when it's time and we just kind of, we move together as a community. And so I learned that in right. basketball some. I learned that in these last few years being home and rooted more. And mm-hmm. I learned it when I was doing my criminal justice learning time, still learning, mm-hmm. but you know, about 5 years yeah. ago, I learned like, oh, this thing is huge. I can't tackle this whole thing.
Yeah.
So
right.
my guy, Mike, told me, pick a lane and run in it and then you can stay sure. above water.
Yeah.
So just right. little lessons here and there from different spheres yeah. of life, you know, asking for help. I guess I've seen it done well, like people sure. in a healthy way, asking for help, getting yeah. help and then becoming healthier. So it didn't necessarily yeah. have a negative connotation. My mom asked yeah. for help and she got help.
Yeah.
And we all need help.
Yeah.
Like, I guess my growing yeah. up, we received help.
Yeah.
And so, and it worked out. And so I entered into motherhood, I think, thankfully with more life experience yeah. of that posture on top of
yeah.
having help that I trust around. So I've got my mom, I've got my godparents, sure. I've got my husband, I've got yeah. an awesome community to where if I need yeah. help, I actually can get it. So that's not
good.
Necessarily yeah. normal either.
No, that's great. So that's really good.
So I've been doing this
yeah.
for almost a year now. He's going to turn one next month.
Good.
And
I don't hear him crying in the background.
So. My daddy's got him.
What have last question? Daddy, yeah,
he's got him.
So last one. I asked this to a few of the other guests, but I'm always fascinated by the answers. So I don't know if JJ, as you call him, will be if you'll have more kids and if you do or don't. But when he's older and he's asked the question by a friend or anyone, what was your mom like? And what was your mom like growing up? What do you wish for? What do you hope for that answer to be?
Oh man, trying to make everybody cry, huh? that's a deep question. One of the most defining questions, right? Your legacy, your impact on the people that know you the best, the people that you can't hide from because they see you. yeah. I would like my baby boy and any future children, Lord willing, we have to say mom was a genuine person. She was authentic. Mm-hmm. She loved really hard and really modeled for me how to live in a way that matters, you know, for what matters most, and really mm-hmm. taught me how to do relationships well. Like, she taught me what it looked like to relate to mm-hmm. my people. Because again, I just feel like relationship, I'm just, as I get older, of like, that's where energy needs to be spent, is in quality,
yeah. yeah,
quality relationships with, you know, your creator, each other, mm-hmm. our environment.
Mm-hmm.
And mom showed me what that looked like. And
yeah,
and she was present. She was there. And
Yeah.
Yeah, just being real, and that it's okay to be real. It's okay to have limits. It's okay to be great. It's okay to be in process. So hopefully he'll say something, something along those lines.
No, it's a great answer. I think there's so many definitions of success that I hear, and the one I like the most is for the people that know you best to love you most. So many people probably love you that don't know you, and that's fine. That's nothing wrong with that. But if you become one of those people that are loved from afar but not from up close, that's not success.
Yeah.
But ours, unfortunately, some people, Maya, would say, even if you didn't have a relationship, which sounds like that would never happen with your son, oh my gosh, Maya's so successful. And then your good friends or your family, and like I said, this won't be you. Yeah, he's not so great.
Yeah.
You know, that is not success, right?
Right.
And your word choice of real and authentic, and it's almost like that's enough, right? Those answers are enough. What was your mom like? She was authentic. She loved me hard. Like she was real. Like that's as high of a compliment. I mean,
right? Who can,
right? What else do you want? Oh, she also won 4, title, but that's good too, right? You'd be like that. Whoa. But if you're going to choose where, what you want the answer to be, you didn't start with, I want my son to know that I won. I was a winner, It's kind of a backwards thing, but you seem to have figured out pretty well the order of things, and that's great. And it's been great. I appreciate having you on, and good luck, and congratulations on the book. And what a life you've led. So thanks for coming on.
Oh, this was awesome. I really enjoyed talking to you. Hopefully I'll meet you in person one day.
Yeah, thank you.